You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, yet more layoffs, this time at Google's parent. That means more than 100,000 tech workers have been laid off since the start of 2022.
And Elon Musk is testifying under oath right now in a multi-billion dollar trial over claims he misled shareholders in 2018 tweets about taking the company private.
And we ask CFTC Commissioner Christy Goldsmith Romero how she suggests the government regulate digital assets. But first, a check-in on those markets. We'll get to digital markets in just a moment. Let's have a little look at what's happening in terms of your NASDAQ. What a day. What a risk on trade. What a desire to get into technology stocks, helped, of course, by some single names that Ed will point out. But the NASDAQ crushing it up 2.7% and really managing to shirk off some of those red screens that we were used to in the rest of the week. So actually it ends on a high note and brings the weekly move, is 4 days, of course, a shortened holiday trading week, into the green. The MSCI All Country World Index was also up on the day. So we saw risk assets rally over in Europe and indeed over in Asia as well. Interesting move that we've seen such lockstep moves in terms of bonds and stocks. In fact, All Country World Index and your overall global ag bond index, they are basically working together. We haven't seen such correlations going back to the 1990s. Today they split direction. Will this be more of a turn of events? Will the 60-40 work once again with bonds actually falling, yields higher, up almost 9 basis points, while of course stocks, they lift on the higher side too. It's all about the Federal Reserve. It's all about macro picture. It's all about hoping that they won't be quite so hawkish. Let's flick it on because, well, what has managed to stay in the risk on rally throughout this week and actually now hitting the highest since September is Bitcoin. We are currently up once again about 7% on the week. We're up about 7% on the day. And Bitcoin over the course of the 6 months, what a torrid time we've been. But we're about more than 40% off of those lows hit back in November, Ed.
Yeah, it's interesting over on my side. Earnings, a big part of the story and the feel-good in public markets. Actually, layoffs, a big part of the equity feel-good story as well. Bear with me on that one. Going to start with Netflix. Biggest jump since November, April high. Why? Well, they really reacted positively, not just to the management changes in Reed Hastings going upstairs to executive chair, Greg Peters becoming co-CEO, but a lot of the street seeing a path forward when it comes to profitability and liking what they're hearing from Netflix about the story for this year. Despite that change isn't always positive. You see SVB Financial, my screen carrier. It's not one you and I talk about often, but this is the parent company of Silicon Valley Bank, a name that lends to a lot of startups, important in our world, but it forecasts net income of $925 to $955 million for the fiscal first quarter, which investors really cheered. I think it was the biggest jump on the stock since 2018. Tesla up 5%. I only point that there because Elon Musk is testifying here in San Francisco in that 2018 take Tesla private tweet trial. Gosh, that was a mouthful. The stock really not trading on that, but interesting to see an upward trajectory on that share's highest level in a month. And then this is what I was talking about. Alphabet, the parent company of Google, announces it's laying off 6% of staff globally. Investors cheer that. You always hear me say, Caro, layoffs are not pleasant, But if you're an investor in this company and you look at this chart next to me about the slowing top line growth and the narrative around the tech sector, protecting EPS, protecting the bottom line throughout 2023, that's what investors want to hear. I know it's painful, but if you're an investor in a company seeking returns, this is what you want them seeing, see them doing in a changing and difficult environment.
Yeah, let's talk about, of course, the layoff that will affect 6% of Google's parent company, Alphabet, 12,000 jobs. And overall, this is a global layoff from the company, and the tech giant is retrenching like many others are after, let's call it, years of abundant growth, of abundant hiring. Bloomberg's Julia Love is here to talk about more of it. And Julia, we need to put it in perspective. 12,000 is a lot of people, and it hurts individuals, we know. But ultimately, they're basically shedding jobs that only take us back to basically kind of a year ago. They just fueled up so much in terms of personnel over COVID.
Absolutely. It's really quite tremendous. Google's headcount has been growing about 20% a year since 2017. And so investors have really been clamoring for them to start hitting the brakes, and they've begun to do that with these layoffs.
Hey, Julia, you know, you do such an amazing job covering the Google Alphabet beat because it's such a diverse company now. You know, it's not just Google search. And what was interesting about your reporting is some of the specific areas where Google is cutting back. Which teams are most impacted?
Absolutely. We're still trying to get to the bottom of that. It does seem that the cuts have been broad-based. However, it seems that Area 120, the famous new idea incubator, has been all but shuttered. There are three projects that are graduating that will be folded into Doodle, but it seems that virtually all other employees, with the exception of the managing director, have been laid off.
Of course, investors had in some ways been asking for this, but previous earnings, they've been talking about needing a focus on margins and having to look more at share buybacks and laying people off. But Julia, what was interesting for me, and I think Ed was sort of hinting at this too, is, well, actually they're laying off or reorganizing, shall we say, the AI part of the business. That's quite notable given everyone seems to be so excited about that focus on artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. You know, it's a really interesting storyline because Google has given the world, you know, much of the cutting edge technology and artificial intelligence. But the release of ChatGPT has really caused a lot of concern over there that Google might be left behind in this technological wave that it helped start. And so the company does really appear to be doing everything it can to drill down and make sure it's not left behind.
You heard me at the top of the show, Julia, talking about the reaction, right? Why are these tech companies doing this? And part of it is a changing environment. You've gone very quickly from mega growth to a little bit slower growth. I'm bringing back up that chart from the Bloomberg Terminal, year-on-year revenue gains, hit by that advertising slowdown in particular. The stock rose. What is it that investors like about this? How does this help protect or impact earnings for Alphabet?
Well, it's interesting because Google's search advertising business is pretty resilient, but the last quarter showed that they were no longer immune. They had disappointing results. And so if the top line is no longer growing, as you said, Ed, then the only way for them to give investors the numbers they want to see is to cut costs.
Julia Love, thank you so much keeping us up to speed with what's happening over at Alphabet. Ed, it was interesting, wasn't it, overall as well? The ways in which companies to protect their own data, we spoke about this earlier in the week, some ways have to act really abruptly. And there was so much on Twitter in particular about people not having seen the email that was sent earlier this morning, maybe trying to badge in, suddenly realizing they couldn't. It's a really tough navigation, isn't it? But it felt like Sundar Pichai at least really tried to own and take responsibility for the layoffs.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, Carrie, the question I've had is the timing around all of this in the space of a single week. And it's as if various peers in the sector were waiting and for the other players to go first. You know, it was a strange week in that respect. But you take it on aggregate, it's 40-odd thousand jobs, you know, confirmed in the space of 5 days. Pretty astonishing.
Yeah, it really is. And the numbers, they rack up. Meanwhile, what's also racking up is what's happening with Elon Musk. We've just been understanding that he's wrapped up testifying at a multi-billion dollar securities fraud trial. Of course, it all stems from the claim that he misled shareholders in 2018 tweets about taking the company private at $4.20 per share. Musk told the jury that he's aware that after he tweets, the stock price move up or down, but that there is no causal relationship. He then advocated for the value of being a private company, stating that being private doesn't prevent you from raising money. We'll have more on that later this hour. And Ed, this is one I know that you keep on following, and the fact that he was there in being examined by his own side, we're going to have to wait for the weekend to see what cross-examination looks like.
Yeah, I find this fascinating because of his character. You know, you and I weren't in the courtroom in San Francisco, but we have colleagues that were, and I cannot wait to hear about strategy because Elon Musk often can't help himself in going to broader issues, talking about short sellers, you know, talking about regulators. And that was part of what, you know, legal academics thought would be the strategy to get him riled up on the stand. I guess we'll find out. Amazon's cloud unit, AWS, will spend $35 billion on new data centers in Virginia by 2040, wanting to stay ahead of rivals Microsoft and Alphabet. A big win for the state of Virginia. Here's what Governor Glenn Allen Youngkin had to say about that earlier today in an exclusive conversation.
This is big. And $35 billion financial commitment's the largest ever made to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Our partnership with AWS started back in 2006 and has only grown. You know, Virginia is the largest market for data centers in the world. And what's most exciting about this is the long-term nature of this commitment. Not only is it $35 billion, but they're going to expand their footprint across the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's going to bring the benefits that come with these jobs, the multiplier effect that with these jobs to the ecosystem that's created, the over 100 businesses that will support the construction of these data centers to localities outside of Northern Virginia directly. And that's great for the Commonwealth of Virginia to see it expand our footprint in data centers and maintain our market leading position.
AWS saying 1,000 new jobs created directly from this. What I find fascinating, Governor, is if you look at the history of the state's relationship with AWS, as you say, I think between 2011 and 2020, they'd already invested $35 billion into your state. And yet incentives through the form of grants and tax exemptions are still at play here. Was this a difficult negotiation?
But there's a negotiation. It's never difficult or easy. There's just a negotiation to represent the taxpayers of Virginia adequately and appropriately. That's my job. And I think we have struck a very good deal. I think that the Virginia will benefit mightily. You know, the ecosystems that develop around the data center infrastructure are enormous. There are thousands and thousands of jobs that will be created in addition to the direct jobs for AWS. There are contractors and supportive companies that will be developed in order to support the construction but the operation. And this will add to the locality substantial funding for schools and services and infrastructure. This is really important to the long-term economic development of the Commonwealth. It's big, as I said, but on top of that, it continues Virginia's leading position in this industry of the future. And it's one that we continue to want to not only lead in, but expand our lead in.
You know, Caro, Virginia becoming a real data center server powerhouse in the East Coast. It has been for some time. Interesting person as well. Potential presidential candidate 2024. You know his background, Carlyle Group. And I was asking about, well, hold on. Why are you doing all these incentives? Why do you have to work so hard for that deal? And his point is net, great win for the state of Virginia.
and why they've been having them since 2006. So it's a great win, but also what's enticing, yes, some of the tax breaks, but also the cheap electricity, right? And these things are just so hungry for that sort of power to be able to keep us all connected. And I think it dovetails nicely with the conversation we're having in terms of layoffs, because of course Amazon's one of them. Of course they're having to lay off 18,000, but they're still having to double down on where it makes sense to where to invest. And clearly what Bank of America and the story you wrote really making clear that this is an area that they're going to continue to spend on in terms of R&D.
Yeah, and I asked about the layoffs. He said, look, I'm always concerned about any layoffs. My understanding is that Amazon did make some small cuts broadly in the state of Virginia, but AWS as a unit continues to grow. That was the story of the day. The story longer term has been about the governor walking away from a potential deal with Ford and CATL because essentially he felt that it was not in the best interest of the state, but he went further than that in the interview, Carrie. Take a listen.
We have a great site in that part of Virginia, and I look forward to bringing a great company there. But it won't be one that uses a kind of a Trojan horse relationship with the Chinese Communist Party in order to gain.
That was kind of fascinating what he was saying about what ultimately this is a Chinese company that he said. What was it? A Trojan horse was the turn of phrase he used.
Yeah. So you know, his logic is that Ford partnering with CATL, the biggest maker of battery cells in the world, is contrary to the spirit of the Inflation Reduction Act, which looks to establish the U.S. supply chain. And he called CATL, a puppet of the Chinese Communist Party, a front for the Chinese Communist Party. And that was his whole logic for saying, no, Ford cannot do this deal for the site in our state. And he said they had many other interested parties. He'd rather do it with something that was not embroiled in controversy, was the way we put it. It was a wide-ranging but intense but interesting conversation with Governor Youngkin.
Yeah, fascinating. All the ways in which you weave it together with your focus on EVs and cars, Ed, as well as your love of all things to do with data centers. Meanwhile, coming up, well, we've got to return to AI, right? It's the story of the day, but Google's AI unit is actually being swept up in the company's 12,000 job cuts, as we mentioned, even though, of course, Sundar Pichai himself is saying AI is still a key investment area for the company. We're going to discuss all of that, how it's impacting AI research and much more with an expert, an AI expert, Wendy Hall. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Now, at a time where AI research is booming, Alphabet's treasured AI unit is actually not escaping the wave of layoffs. Indeed, it will be reorganized, the company said, as part of the company's sweeping job cuts that were announced today, according to a memo seen by Bloomberg. Let's bring in about the focus on AI, about the ethics that swept up in that, and indeed how governments oversee it all. Wendy Hall, for her insight on all of this. She is, of course, a professor of computer science at the University of Southampton over in the United Kingdom, so she's staying up late for us. Of course, she was the co-chair of the UK government's AI review published back in 2017. And I think as a Brit, that's always what so interested me, is that the UK, in many ways, due to DeepMind, due to some of the real AI prowess, has thought about the way in which you need to oversee this, the ethics involved, had government relationships, academics as well, such as yourself. And when it, ultimately, this all stems, our exuberance, our interest around ChatGPT. At the heart of it, at the moment, are you worried or excited? Can you balance, like, is one more than the other?
Typical academic answer. Hello, and thank you for inviting me on tonight. It's fine. It's both. ChatGPT has shown people who don't understand anything about AI what the possibilities are and what the potentially negative consequences are. So I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes to what the issues are around the AI that we, you know, many of us have been talking about for a number of years. And we have to get governments to think about how best to regulate this new, very fast emerging industry.
Ultimately, that review that you published back in 2017, has it turned into anything tangible? I have to say the UK political situation has been, well, tumultuous at best, but has there been any movements towards ensuring there is the right overseeing?
Well, yes. We actually are about to produce a regulation paper. A white paper will be coming out in this spring from the Office for AI, that was created as a result of the review we did in 2017. I'm on the AI Council, which was created as a result of the review 2017. We've had a lot of money put into AI for a small country our size. We hit way above our weight in AI. We can't ever be Google or Stanford or MIT, but you know, we have fantastic universities doing amazing and training. We put a lot of money into training people for this new industry, and the AI regulation paper, as I said, is due out this quarter, which will be the UK government's take on how we begin to regulate AI. It will be different to the EU Act. We won't go to statutory law straight away, and it will be sector-based as well to start with. It's all very early. You know, we're just, ChatGPT has shown people the complexity of what you've got to regulate. And it's not just about what governments do, it's what industry does itself. And it's very interesting to hear the news from Google, because I imagine their OpenAI is quite a threat to Google. And I imagine they're restructuring big time. They want different types of people, because they're going to have to take that OpenAI threat very seriously. And of course, it's Microsoft that's backing OpenAI now. Very interesting AI wars coming up between the tech companies. And of course, the UK and Europe, we don't want everything happening outside of our countries. You know, we have all sorts of issues which would be, we need to worry about data sovereignty, we need to worry about digital IDs. You know, there's so many things to think about.
Well, Wendy, I wanted to ask you about that point, because essentially what the current tools do, if you think about ChatGPT or DALL-E, is they take existing content, text or commands in the case of ChatGPT, images in the case of DALL-E. I don't know if you saw it, but there was a deep dive by my colleagues at Bloomberg Law about the first US copyright lawsuit. Yes. And I guess the inference is, how does that limit what you can put in to the language models in order to get something out? What's your reaction to that?
That piece that your team sent me about an hour ago, it's fascinating, because we're going to see a lot more of those types of legal challenges. Because if you take ChatGPT, it is effectively trained on any text that is available on the internet. So that's anything that you get from Google, from Wikipedia, from anything people have put up on their own sites, and DALL-E the same with images. Now, what it shows us is that these AI tools at the moment don't create, right? They copy, they predict, they very cleverly merge ideas, integrate ideas semantically, which is one of the things I've been interested in. They don't create. that. So I think it's absolutely, I mean, you think about the effect on the music industry, which has had a lot of bashing from technology generally anyway, let alone the poets. I mean, lots of people have got ChatGPT to write poetry. Well, a lot of that is based on styles of poetry that ChatGPT has been trained on and the internet. And the other thing to remember also with things like ChatGPT and DALL-E, they are very, very, very expensive to run. They have huge supercomputers and that produce this, looking over the internet, harvesting of the information on the internet and doing the natural language processing and all the work they have to do. This won't stay free forever. It can't do. It cannot stay free forever. And the really interesting thing, I think ChatGPT, they were very clever because they've probably driven the price of the company up with that. Does that make any sense to you? Mm. So Microsoft is looking to invest money into it. And I sort of find it to say, there was a time when Microsoft was the bad guy and all this. But I trust Microsoft to be careful with what they're doing. They're investing huge amounts of money. And it won't be free forever.
Wendy Hall, Professor of Computer Science, University of Southampton. We are going to have to get you back on the program. We didn't even scratch the surface this time around.
No,
Thank you so much.
I'm happy to.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde in New York, and let's turn to the crypto world, because not only is Bitcoin on a tear, there's so much more news, in particular Genesis, the lender backed by Barry Silbert's digital currency group, of course, while it finally filed for bankruptcy, becoming yet the latest firm to collapse in the aftermath of FTX's swift downfall. Now, meanwhile, former FTX US President Brett Harrison has just raised money, $5 million of it, for a new startup from some pretty notable names. You know, the notable name who's across all of this is Shanali Basak, and she's here to explain. Staying late for us, we appreciate it after what a week of bank earnings and everything else for you. Talk to us about Genesis. How important is this that they finally filed bankruptcy?
It's very important because it's another way to get forward in terms of getting people their money back at the end of the day, at least to some degree. In a bankruptcy process, very typically, what's understood here is you might not get it all. There are earlier discussions, as you've seen reported in multiple outlets, as well as through some of the creditor committee communications, is that maybe there'd be a sense of getting 70 cents on the dollar or so. But listen, as you go through this process, what you're really going to want to see is some sense of agreement among each of the different creditor groups, which have a different set of standings with the company in this process. Now, importantly, $3.5 billion nearly is owed to the top 50 creditors. $760 million of that is tied to Gemini and Gemini entities. Yes. That Gemini earned business that had halted withdrawals. There's more than 340,000 customers that are owed money. While you watch this progress, the relationship with Gemini will be very, very important, especially as you watch them kind of turn the page on this. Lastly, I would say, interestingly, and why this is so important, is because there's some sense of containment here. If you look at the bankruptcy filings, it definitely alludes to the relationship between Digital Currency Group, the parent company here, run by Barry Silbert, as well as its relationship and intercompany loans to Genesis and Genesis Global Capital in particular. But the fact that this is contained in a bankruptcy to Genesis Global Capital and doesn't involve, say, the Genesis trading business, shows you that this is contained. $3.5 billion is certainly a lot of money, but at the same time, we know where a lot of those creditors are, who they are, and how much they're owed.
Unlike the FTX bankruptcy,
certainly,
which doesn't feel contained. And what's interesting is actually talk this week of US-based FTX becoming an exchange again. I mean, how are people reacting to that?
There's a lot of mixed feelings about that because the brand itself carries a lot of
toxicity.
That's a better word for it at this point. To the point that I think this struck me. This is a story that came out late last night out of the court papers that have been coming through the lawyers here for Sam Bankman-Fried. A car drove into a barricade at his parents' home. Mm. I thought that was pretty striking. And when the security guard at the home confronted the three men in the car, the men said something to the effect of, you won't be able to keep us out. The reason that this was in filings for Sam Bankman-Fried was because there's been a lot of notoriety behind the case, and they're trying to keep the names private of the people who are helping back this bail package.
Let's talk about names involved in FTX of old. because one's come back to the fore. You broke the news with Brett Harrison raising money. And what was striking to me is who he's raising money from.
There, think about how interesting this is. This story has been so highly anticipated. It's been drips and drips of leaks about his conversations with venture capitalists. Remember, he left FTX US months before the implosion. A lot of information has come out between his kind of difficult relationship here between Sam Bankman-Fried and him. He had a Twitter thread over the weekend. We had a conversation with him about what he's trying to accomplish here. He says he wants to hire. He's raised $5 million through Coinbase Ventures, Circle, Anthony Scaramucci. Remember, a lot of these parties here are kind of FTX adversaries, if you will. Remember, the Salt businesses, the SkyBridge business that it's associated with had an investment from the FTX Ventures unit. And I remember being there myself. And it's really Brett with the relationship with Scaramucci. So he's trying to turn the page. He's trying to hire former FTX employees and trying to build trading infrastructure for institutions. He says he wants to reinstall confidence in the industry. Let's see if he can do it.
Well, there's some other people who want to reinstall some confidence in the industry and how it's going to be regulated. Shalani's going to be sticking around for this next conversation because our next guest plays a key role in the policymaking decisions over digital assets. CFTC Commissioner Christy Goldsmith-Romero says that, look, the FTX implosion must lead to more scrutiny of US-based crypto companies. Earlier this week, she said, quote, I urge Congress to avoid permitting newly regulated crypto exchanges to self-certify products for listing under the current process that limits CFTC oversight. She also said the CFTC would benefit from greater authority to access certain information on unregulated affiliates of regulated exchanges with appropriate conditions. Pleased to say, Commissioner Goldsmith-Romero joins us now from DC. Commissioner, fascinating that ultimately what you're calling for here is for your institution to have a bit more power, to be able to have more control. What is it? Can you explain about the self-certification? What is it that so worries you? What situations have you seen already that that's led to some problems?
Yeah, so ultimately what I'm calling for is really like more comprehensive whole of government regulation, very similar to what we have with like traditional finance, TradFi, right? So it's going to be multiple government agencies involved that's going to have greater customer protections and stronger federal oversight. So if, you know, we have this additional authority that's provided to the CFTC, like over the regular Bitcoin market or over the spot market, I don't think we can just port over the rules that we have now that relates to the futures market that we have, like the Bitcoin futures market that we regulate. So I think, you know, we don't want to fast track assets that are going to be listed on exchanges. The CFTC should have more authority over that. We want to make sure that someone's not trying to do an end run around the SEC with their jurisdiction. We want to make sure that we can protect the market against manipulation. And, you know, at this point, it's going to be very, very difficult for some exchange to self-certify that what they put on is not readily susceptible to manipulation. And there's a lot of issues with that. So it's really kind of coming up with a new process because it would be a new market and it would need strong oversight.
What was so interesting was perhaps a lack of oversight and due diligence from some internal players within the system. As this new burgeoning area of crypto evolved, there was a lot of money, a FOMO feel, people pouring investment into now, well, failed companies. And many of us in the media and elsewhere asked, what about those institutional players? What about the due diligence that completely was lacking at certain VCs? People who've been around for years, for decades, that just seem to lose their head in this situation. Are enough questions being asked of those institutional players about their accountability? Do you think?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. There are serious, serious questions about whether they fulfilled their fiduciary duties to their clients. What kind of due diligence did they conduct? Let's just start with the fact that if you are investing hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars that in a company a year later or so, you have to write it down to zero or close to zero. That's already going to raise questions about the due diligence you're conducting. But when the new FTX CEO, John Ray, says in court and in the bankruptcy filings, there's absolutely no record keeping. Right, there's absolutely no controls. We've got an auditor no one's ever heard of. Then you say, well, how is that possible? So did they turn a blind eye to it? Were they just distracted by like this promise of innovation? You know, we know that FTX and its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, really chased trying to get the public trust. everything they did, the messaging was, we're trustworthy, you can trust in us. We know now that that's not true, right? That they violated the trust. But, you know, we have this situation where, you know, the market was hot. There was a lot of competition in there, a lot of equity to be had. And, you know, why did they turn a blind eye to what should have been really flashing red lights when it comes to due diligence? So I do think there are serious questions there. There might actually be conflicts too. You see this highly interconnected nature. So was there some conflicts that prevented them from really paying attention to the due diligence and the facts that they were uncovering?
Self-certification, something that's interesting to me too, that whether it's self-certifying certain assets that are being listed or just going ahead and providing certain products to clients, lending products, other products. I mean, how much now, whether it's the CFTC, the SEC, or the Department of Justice, how much cleanup work is there to do? It seems like, based on the velocity of cases that are being brought forward, even above and beyond FTX, that there's a lot of enforcement by regulation, and there's a lot more conviction in regulators and authorities saying, hey, these are new products with the same classifications as some of the old financial products we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the products have very similar features, and there's a lot of the same risk that you see in crypto that you saw in traditional finance. First of all, we've been regulating in the futures space and allowing trading to happen in Bitcoin futures and Ether futures as long as it's registered with us. And FTX actually had Ledger X, which was one of their entities registered with us, which is not part of the bankruptcy. But the fact of the matter is, we also have to do enforcement. We have to bring, trust and confidence to the American people that we are doing our job. We have this police authority to go in and to bring enforcement actions. We have to do that. That helps keep the market clean, and that's an important part of our job. And I'm a 20-year federal law enforcement official, so to me, enforcement is part of regulation, but we're doing both at the CFTC, both trying to supervise it, the trading that we can, where we have authority, and bringing enforcement cases, even though we don't have regulatory authority, but we have enforcement authority in the cash market.
Commissioner, a sensitive one for you because you talk about confidence. Mm-hmm. We asked our own audience how confident they were that regulation would come to bear. We asked them a little while back, in the wake of FTX, are you confident the right crypto regulation will come? Well, 38% said don't hold your breath, and actually 36% said no. What can you do now? What can you say? What do you think you're able to get across that gives people the confidence that it can be brought in and we're not just depending on basically self-regulation?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of people in Congress on a bipartisan basis who want to do something. I mean, when I look at this, you got a lot of regular people who are getting crushed in these bankruptcies. Think of like Celsius, and now you're going to have Genesis. You've got FTX. You've got a lot of people who need some customer protection. So I think there's a lot of goodwill in Congress to get something through. I do think it's appropriate to take a pause after FTX for Congress to say, have we made sure that any legislation we're thinking about like addresses all of the lessons learned that we have from FTX. And that's what led me to say, you know what, we should really think about this idea of this fast track self-certification process. I, as a regulator, would want to have more oversight tools over exchanges to be able to say, no, that's not appropriate, to have some independence governance and to have some control. So I think the possibility is there. But let me just say, I understand it's going to take time to do this right in a comprehensive way. But what matters the most is that we get something right that stands the test of time.
You know, it's interesting that you worked in the wake of the financial crisis with the troubled asset relief program. So you have seen very messy unwinds. This time around, there is a lot of relief that it wasn't a more systemic problem. To the extent that you're still worried about systemic problems, especially with places that do intersect more seriously with the current financial system, stable coins, how much concern do you still have?
So I have a lot of concern about financial stability risks. Let's separate that out from systemic risk. Financial stability risk is not something we take our eyes off. We have to continue to look at that. When you look at all these people that are hurt, when you look at the domino effect that happens when all of these different investors come in, and we're still seeing the impact of FTX's collapse right now. Systemic risk is going to come, in my mind, as you get more links between the traditional financial market and the crypto market. Over the last 6 months, I've heard more and more of TradFi say that they want to become interested. And that's why I've been warning, well, if you're going to become interested, you really have to understand kind of how this operates. You really have to understand where there are some weaknesses. Commingling customer assets with company assets is a big weakness. Lots of conflicts of interest that are not resolved is a big weakness. Cybersecurity, the same. You've got to really have strong cybersecurity issues. So I think, you know, as the traditional financial players are sort of looking into this, you know, there's still some interest, but hopefully this is going to take everyone, you know, make a pause and do better due diligence.
Oh, speaking of due diligence, speaking of commingling, I'm kind of curious about your sense of the difference between what happened at Genesis and what happened over at FTX. Obviously, no one has been accused of anything at Genesis, but there's been a concern from the Winklevoss twins here about the potential commingling between the intercompany loans at Genesis. Now that they're going through a bankruptcy process of their own, how does a regulator, how does the CFTC look at something like that in terms of just general corporate behavior?
Yeah, so I'm going to be careful about speaking about any particular company because we are a law enforcement office, and so I want to be careful about that. But I will say we are looking across the industry. We are looking to where we're going to bring cases. We are bringing cases constantly, you know, bringing cases against a Dow, bringing cases against an Oracle manipulator, bringing cases, we brought a case against Tether about how stable their stablecoin is. So I think our job is to sort of look across and say, you know, where is it appropriate to bring the case in a way that not only brings, you know, compliance with the law, but also sends a message to others who are in the market about, you know, what we expect, good behavior.
Commissioner, great to have some time with you on this Friday. CFTC Commissioner Christy Goldsmith Romero and Shanali Basak, as always, thank you so much for your time. Meanwhile, coming up, Elon Musk could lose billions for that funding secured tweet back in 2018. We have the latest on the securities fraud trial from our reporter who is in that very courtroom. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
So in the last hour or so, Elon Musk has been testifying in part of the trial over his funding secured tweet back in 2018 to take Tesla private at $420 a share. That tweet could potentially cost him billions of dollars in damages. Joe Rosenblatt was in the courtroom, our legal reporter for Bloomberg News. So what were the takeaways? This was just the early exchanges, the early part of Musk's time on the stand.
Yeah, it was very early in the sense that we spent all day hearing from other witnesses, and there was great anticipation in the courtroom. Everybody knew that we could hear from Elon Musk, but we weren't sure if we were going to before kind of the time ran out for the day. And so he came in, and everybody was very excited, but he spoke for, he testified for about 30 minutes, meaning that he kind of came and went and will return on Monday.
How did he feel, Joel? Like, how did he seem? How did his lawyer seem? How did other people giving evidence seem?
Yeah, he seemed nervous, really quite nervous, I think, at first. And he was very quiet, reticent, and very hesitating in his responses. I think very careful and calculated in weighing what he was being asked and what he said. But he very quickly warmed up then and got relaxed and even funny in the courtroom in a kind of mild way, not overly humorous, but warmed up and got kind of comfortable. His lawyer, the plaintiff's lawyer, the lawyer representing the shareholders, was also nervous. Asking Elon Musk with Elon Musk on the stand. He's British, and as you know, Ed, that confers great kind of authority and intelligence, especially in a backwater like San Francisco. But he was unsettled too, and it took them a while to kind of get used to each other, is what it felt like.
Ed's Welsh.
Yeah, I've got no comment on that. All I would say is let's remind the audience that the plaintiffs, the shareholders, basically argue that they lost money due to the price swings on Tesla stock in the days that followed that 2018 take private tweet, right? That's the context. What was fascinating for me is even before Musk got anywhere near that courthouse, the judge had made a pre-trial decision of his own, a pre-trial hearing decision about how those tweets should be interpreted. Could you talk to us about that background?
Sure. I mean, to kind of cut through it, the judge has ruled that the tweets were false and reckless. And those are kind of two big hurdles that the shareholders have to clear in order to win their case. And so it's unusual, if not unprecedented, in a case like this, for a judge to find that ruling ahead of time and then furthermore instruct the jury. So the trial, it's settled that these are false, these tweets are false, and that they were reckless. The question that they have to determine now is, did Elon Musk know that? What was his state of mind? Did he know that they were false, and did he know that they were that what he was saying would impact shareholders and move the price of the stock?
Joel, it was interesting that you were saying he eventually warmed up, became humorous slightly. And Ed was making an interesting point earlier in the show about perhaps whether the idea, the motivation here is to get him riled up, because we know from Twitter that Elon Musk can be outspoken, as a way of politely saying it. Do you think that that's kind of a tactic at play here?
I do think it's a tactic. I think the lawyers for the shareholders are they're trying to provoke him. And they asked, questions that I think are heading in that direction, including about, I think we probably all recall his response or his tweets about the horrible cave situation with the children stuck kind of in a cave in Thailand, and his horrible kind of tweets about that. And the lawyer, asked him questions about that, trying to provoke him to make the point that what he says on Twitter matters to Tesla shareholders. Mm. And he made the point that in that instance, Tesla shares dropped significantly after he made that tweet. Musk was steadfast, insisting that there's no link between what he says and Tesla share prices. He said that repeatedly and kind of really resisted that. He did a good job, of resisting it. But we're going to see where this goes on Monday.
Joel, fascinating. We thank you. You've just jumped up a room above the courtroom itself. So thank you so much, Joel Rosenblatt, for sticking around in that courthouse. Going viral. the reality behind the tens of thousands of tech workers who've lost their jobs. Hashtag layoffs was trending on Twitter, and Google, whose parent company Alphabet, of course, is shrinking its global workforce by about 6%. One tweet in particular, it caught our attention. Even though an email went out to Google employees overnight, we understand, some who actually missed it were allegedly waiting in line to badge in to their offices, which ultimately told them whether or not they lost their jobs. I mean, we haven't corroborated this ourselves, Ed, but it was notable that people seemed to be responding to that. People who worked there a long time, and we know that it's really tough to get these messages across.
Yeah, Google layoffs, the number one trend on Google Trends. That I don't make light of that. That's the reality we're in.
Yeah, 100,000 so far since the beginning of 2022. We'll keep you abreast of all that sort of news. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology.
Don't forget, podcast, iHeart, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get it, this is Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.